Blog Talk.
Jelonski. Some of you know me from the blog world. Some of you know me from my journalism. What you were just hearing were sounds from the very first few hours of Occupy Wall Street. The crowd had swarmed. I believe the original place was down at Chase Manhattan Plaza where they were going to camp out, and they were blocked off after swarming around the Bull, where they were also blocked off. They would eventually head over to Zuccotti Park. And as I caught up with the crowd, which was still in about six or seven locations at the time, this is what they were chanting. And I think at the time, many of us were surprised that anybody was going to stay past those first few hours, and it ended up being a dare in many ways in the mood of the situation. And over the course of the next 4 months, of course, there were a variety of police reactions, labor reactions, and then ultimately, the movement has been processed both by media and law enforcement and those of us at home and the democracy in different ways. We're going to be hearing a little bit later about how labor and the police processed the Occupy Wall Street movement and are currently dealing with it. And we're also going to hear about how Occupy Wall Street is dealing with the court system while it is itself being dealt with by the court system. But for now, on Practicing Tomorrow, sponsored by Here Be Monsters, Roundtree 7, and all the good folks out there, we'll be listening to a few more sounds from the first day. For example, one of the few quirky things sort of forgotten in the newer histories is that this brass band came out right at the start. I'm still not sure about who hired them. And as the very first GA was going on, when a bullhorn was still allowed, this brass band started playing. The end that sort of backfired on them there, and the crowd actually started cheering for the patriotic songs that the brass band was playing in an attempt to drown out the crowd. And in many ways, that would sort of come to be part of the story of the next 4 months. Not only what was Occupy Wall Street saying and who are they bringing and what kind of participatory democracy, as opposed to just electoral democracy, what sort of participatory democracy they were bringing to the table, but besides all that, what was the reaction that they were getting from the community, from law enforcement, from media, and then from the populace as a whole, which really makes up the mechanics of a democracy, But at this stage in the game, no one even knew that Occupy Wall Street was going to turn and roll out into this huge message, into this huge populist movement with hundreds of offshoots in cities across America and both hemispheres. And so at the time, nobody really was sure what Occupy Wall Street was trying to do. Never mind the message, but what were they trying to do? The idea of staying over at the park and occupying, that was just one idea. What were they trying to get out? And what they did was, after the brass band stopped playing, they actually broke the crowd down into about 10, 11, or 12, and by they I mean about 15, 20 people, helped get together a general assembly and suggested that we break the crowd down into circles, and then folks should sit around and explain what they think the problems are, what they think some of the solutions might be, and how maybe folks can start working towards those solutions. And here's some of the audio from that.
If there are folks who are comfortable facilitating a different way, but it's a little bit unrealistic for a Democratic project, large, beautiful group of people. So if we can break into two or three different groups and start talking about the problems that we're facing as a generation and try and come up with solutions.
The young man you hear speaking there was actually among the first arrested at Occupy Wall Street. You can actually look it up on YouTube. What happened was that the police were trying to shut down the live streaming computer area, and he was one of the people trying to defend it. And you can kind of check it out on YouTube and see that there was a fracas, and then the cops just sort of assault him, 5, 6, 7 strong, pin him to the ground, plant their weight on him, and drag him off. Now, whether it's an arrest, an aggressive arrest, or even like hundreds of people have experienced being detained without being arrested, just being held in a section of the park without being completely arrested, this has a sort of chilling effect on movements and on participatory or popular democracy when you don't think of democracy as just a ballot box. That's electoral democracy. We're thinking of participatory democracy, 365-day-a-year sort of democracy. Well, if you're trying to do that, and there's sort of an overreaction from law enforcement, this, of course, has a very specific effect. It makes protesters look criminal. It makes democratic action look criminal. Having covered the protests from the first day, this sort of reaction left me with a very specific impression. Also, the reaction, or perhaps early lack of reaction from labor, also made an impression on myself and perhaps a lot of people who were down at the Occupy Wall Street movement. So I wanted to get a perspective that was a little bit bigger. I wanted to talk to somebody with a little more expertise on how labor worked, on how police worked, both in New York City and as a whole, and perhaps how police worked as a labor unit themselves. So I spoke to Ari Paul, a very well-known labor journalist. His works have appeared in Al Jazeera, The Nation, The Guardian, and of course, The New York Independent. As someone who has written about labor and the police for years now, I wanted to ask Ari about the police reaction to Occupy Wall Street. I also wanted to ask him about one specific Occupy Wall Street reaction to the police, namely the repeating chant that police, too, are part of the 99%. I also wanted to ask Ari, as someone who's written about labor for so long, about labor's shifting reactions to Occupy Wall Street. Now in its fourth month, the movement has seen increasing ties with organized labor. I wanted to get Ari's impression of what Occupy Wall Street could learn from organized labor, and perhaps what organized labor could learn from Occupy Wall Street.
How you doing, Ari?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing good.
So it's a lovely day. It seems like summer here. Let's talk a little bit about Occupy Wall Street and the police. You wrote this fantastic piece about not the 99%. You've actually spoken about it, too. You were at the Brett Forum recently speaking about Occupy Wall Street. And you had a few years of experience with labor. And I'm just curious about sort of where do you see the varying levels of repression at the NYPD, and what is behind that? Do you find that different levels of, like, you know, we're going to tolerate it today, we're going to kick their ass tomorrow, you know what I mean? Is that from an institutional policy? Is that some sort of, you know, is it sort of like an institutional psychology, or is it now you're just being a nuisance and we'd like to get the sales season going? You know, or is it a combination? in your opinion?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a combination, and often it depends on the individual cop, regardless of their rank. I mean, one thing that, you know, became very apparent in the early days of Occupy was with the, you know, the first pepper spray incident that was a quote-unquote white shirt, someone who was a, you know, commanding officer, not someone, you know, a rough-and-tumble rookie. And, you know, while you might, you know, if you go down to Occupy Wall Street on any given protest, you might have one cop who is very polite and, you know, just tells you to get along, and then you see another cop just kind of, you know, lose their mind a bit and, you know, wail on someone. And so to a certain extent, that is, you know, that just depends on the person, depends on the day, depends on the protester. Some protester might just do something that sets someone off. But I think it's also, you know, it's imperative to really look at the police response at Occupy Wall Street as opposed to the various big gatherings that we have all across the city. I mean, on New Year's Eve, right, there was an attack on the Zuccotti Park, not even protesters, celebrators, down in Zuccotti Park. Whereas, you know, every year there are, you know, multitudes of drunk, you know, reckless drunks in Times Square that don't, you know, elicit this, you know, this type of behavior. And I think a lot of that, you know, is cultural. There's a cultural divide between the protesters and the police, even if there are some messages at Occupy Wall Street that could resonate with individual cops. But I think there is just, if you look back over the course of the Bloomberg administration and preceding that with the Giuliani administration, of just building hostility between protesters and the cops. After a couple of years of protesters having to litigate against the police, whether it was with the RNC or previous protests, it's just going to leave more and more distrust between the two.
And, I mean, so we addressed that a little bit there. It seems like there would be places where Occupy Wall Street could sort of make inroads with the NYPD. On the other hand, it seems like, you know, there's no inroads to message. You know, there's, you know, the unions perhaps aren't so accepting. Are there inroads sort of between, you know, Occupy Wall Street and the NYPD? Should those inroads be made? Is it something that Occupy Wall Street, it takes too much resources for what they're going to get back? You know, is the NYPD accessible, in short, to Occupy Wall Street as a movement?
I think it would be difficult. Partly because a lot of the more mainstream progressive organizations have always taken a contrarian stance to the NYPD. Most notably is the work of the New York Civil Liberties Union, going after things like stop and frisk. And other groups who have tried to, say, reform Rockefeller drug laws or the way drug laws are enforced. I think that's already kind of drawn a line in the sand with the NYPD. And, you know, to be fair, the NYPD has become a lot more closed to community outreach. I think there was actually a time, probably, you know, several administrations ago when community policing was a more popular idea. I think that's sort of fallen by the wayside. And so I think there are fewer avenues to approach the police and, you know, try and, you know, come to some sort of understanding. I mean, I see OWS protesters kind of start talking to cops, and sometimes, you know, they might have a conversation about politics.
Yeah, I've seen that,
And I think that's fine. And I think that, you know, you sort of see these interesting conversations that happen, but at the end of the day, they're not going to refuse an order.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to say like, oh, could OWS reach out to the cops and say, is there a better way to handle this? I mean, if that happens, I mean, the reason I feel pessimistic about that is I don't see other groups who've been able to do that. I mean, there's stop and frisk going on in all these different communities. I've never seen, you know, the minority leadership of this of this city who has worked tirelessly to try to come to some, you know, to reach some meeting point with the cops, but I mean, stop and frisk is still going very strong. So if that political establishment hasn't been able to find an inroad, I don't think OWS could.
So in some ways, can I pitch you a hypothetical? You know, like what happens? Let's say it could happen to that cop who's like, well, you know what? Maybe you're right. I'm not executing the order to protest. Let's just take that hypothetical. How what would be the PD's or the police department's reception to that officer? if for not enforcing an order to you know disperse a protest, or let's say a pack of officers.
Yeah, I mean,
it's one of those things that I've never really considered. You know, what happens to the cop? Let's say it did happen. You know, who's like, well, no, this is right. I can't.
Well, I mean, they, you know, they would be breaking department code. They would be brought before, you know, the internal mechanisms of the department. And I don't know if there'd actually be any criminal charges against them, but they would probably be dismissed. I mean, the NYPD has a fairly sophisticated internal processes of dealing with police who do bad things. I mean, you know, one example is the case of the bike cop, the cop who pushed the cop was named Patrick Pogue, and he pushed a critical mass protester off his bike. It was recorded, he faced criminal charges, but was also, you know, dealt with. And because he was only a rookie cop, he didn't have union protections to keep him on the job, and he was let go. I mean, I think any cop who either declined an order or was hesitant about an order or talked back to a commanding officer is going to see some kind of discipline. Mm-hmm. And I think very few... I mean, I think it would have to be pretty remarkable circumstances to see police in New York really do that. I mean, you know, another hypothetical example is if there were, you know, more investigations into... police activity at Occupy Wall Street, to what degree would police speak up to say, oh yes, you know, so-and-so officer did do something wrong? I mean, the police have a very strong, the so-called blue wall of silence. You don't tattle, no matter what. You don't talk to internal affairs, and you don't turn on your fellow officers. Mm-hmm. I know there are some outstanding investigations, outstanding probes into what's going on. And so I would say, before we see any cops refusing orders, I'd be interested to see if cops are going to participate in some of these probes about, you know, excesses.
Well, that's very interesting. You know, I think one of the things that's sort of being considered differently than maybe a year ago is unions. You know, some folks are sort of pulling for things to maybe be a little more progressive and push more into political issues. But we look at the cop union. And, you know, you gave these three great examples in your indie article. It's more like a syndicate. They don't really unionize to stand up for political issues. They sort of unionize for their own sort of, like, immediate gains. And then can you sort of explain how that, you know, like, because that does fit on a range of unions. And some, you know, to sort of, like, noobs to politics, it's weird to hear, hey, this might be a conservative union. You know?
Yeah, I mean, to give the broad answer, in the American labor movement, there's essentially two types of unions. There are industrial unions and there are craft unions. And so an industrial union, just to use an example in this city, would be the Transport Workers Union. They represent every title, or nearly every title, in the transit force. They represent the conductors, they represent the station agents, they represent the janitors, they represent the people who maintain the tracks. They all those people are represented by Transportation Workers Local 100. And so there becomes this sort of, there's a solidarity among classes because there are people, there are jobs that are done maybe by one demographic, maybe that's dominated by one ethnic group, and then you have different titles that have difference in pay. And so there's this idea that all these people are coming together under the umbrella of one union. You put your identity of the job, you know, to the side, but you sort of come together as a union. And that's sort of seen as a more progressive, more all-encompassing form of trade unionism. With craft unions, you see unions who just represent, you know, a title based on skill. So you go to, you know, if you go to a construction site, you just have, like, people who are in, like, the iron, you know, workers union or the steam fitters. And that is often seen as a conservative approach to unionism because it's just people who, again, you know, they might be representative of one demographic, and they're just advocating for what affects, you know, iron workers or what affects steam fitters. And so cops, like a lot of uniformed services in New York City, fall into that category of craft unionism. You just have a union that represents the interests of detectives or just represents the interests of police officers. There's really no incentive for them to be a part of the greater labor movement. There's really no reason politically for Pat Lynch, the head of the Patrolmen's Union, to advocate for a living wage or to, talk about immigration rights. Whereas, some of the more progressive unions are getting involved in that. For Pat Lynch, the only way he's going to get reelected is if he remains popular by making sure there are raises, ensuring that disciplinary charges against officers are kept at a minimum and that they're protected against the Internal Affairs Bureau. Because that's where the power of the union, or the president finds his or her power, there's really no need to be progressive. I mean, in the case of the detectives union, the detectives union, Michael Palladino, I'll give him credit because he was actually very active with lobbying for federal funding for 9/11 workers, which affects a whole range of people, whether or not they be firefighters or that actually affected a lot of immigrants because there were a lot of immigrant workers involved in that as well. So I'll give him credit there. But on the other hand, a lot of that union was in the past couple of years, made its name for protecting the people in the Sean Bell case, which where the progressive end of the political spectrum was on the other side, and that actually caused a lot of friction with some other unions, because a lot of black union leaders were marching with the Bell family, and so that was a schism there. So
there we were. We're talking kind of on the subject of conservative unions, and Allies and Labor has had sort of like a shifting relationship, right? And, we see probably more conservative places like the New York City Council of Labor, I believe they're called, support, but tacitly, while other people like some of the nurses' unions, the nurses' union, I believe, came out very strong for Occupy Wall Street. So can you maybe talk about sort of what impacts a union when Occupy Wall Street arrives sort of as a message to say we're going to be silent, we're going to be sort of kind of supportive, or we're going to be way behind this? What are the characteristics of the union for that response?
You mean in terms of what has labor's role been in terms of supporting Occupy Wall Street?
Mm-hmm. And how's that varied, I guess?
I think there has been credit should be given where credit is due. And when there was a threat of an eviction in Zuccotti Park, I believe that was in October, when Brookfield Properties said that they were going to clean the park. Various large unions, and then the major union federation, the AFL-CIO, sent an email blast to members urging them to go to Zuccotti Park to defend against the eviction. Whether or not people did this, I think, isn't the point. I think as I quoted Janice Fine in one of my indie articles, it's pretty remarkable that the AFL-CIO was telling members to, confront the police in defense of an explicitly anti-capitalist direct action. That is progress in and of itself. Whether or not, and then, you have unions who are participating in a number of ways. I know that District Council 37 is providing office space for Occupy Wall Street protesters, and I also think the United Federation of Teachers and the Professional Staff Congress, which represents professors at the City University of New York, also provides that sort of in-kind support. Mm-hmm. I know Transport Workers Union brought food and brought other supplies to Occupy Wall Street. Whether or not they were sort of out there with their members getting arrested, I think is one thing. But I think a lot of them were being, actually supportive, and not just in words, but in material support. On the other hand, a lot of it was sort of coincidental. There was this big demonstration in October by the major unions that kind of converged with Occupy Wall Street, Zuccotti Park, and it became this big joint effort, but people had to remember that labor march was scheduled long before OWS had actually been an idea. I don't think that the labor movement had really... planned on doing anything with Occupy Wall Street in its first days. In fact, I was at a union convention in Seattle during the first days of Occupy Wall Street, and people were, the people's sort of range from being dismissive to we'll see where it goes. And I think when people actually saw that this was getting major media attention, that people were willing to get arrested and come back the next day, that people in the labor movement actually started to say, okay, maybe this group of kids, you know, knows something we don't, and we should actually, you know, pay more attention to this. And as I've said, I think the question that we should be asking is not what labor unions can do for Occupy Wall Street. The question should be, what should Occupy Wall Street do for the unions? Because, I mean, ever since the 70s in this country, you know, unionization has been on the decline. The power of unions has been on decline. There have been some piecemeal gains, but have been overwhelmed by the losses. And so I think, you know, if labor's whatever form it's going to look like in this country is going to survive, I think it really has to have new tactics. And I think that's going to, you know, the mainstream labor movement has more to learn from Occupy Wall Street than I think Occupy Wall Street has to learn from the mainstream labor movement.
I mean, to be fair, where was the last time we remember, like, one of the major unions shutting down the Brooklyn Bridge or shutting down Broadway or taking over major squares, you know? So I could definitely understand that. So what are some of those things that maybe the union movement should pick up out of Occupy Wall Street? Tactics, messaging, what kind, you know, or what's some of the tool set that maybe you can transfer over?
Well, on an ideological level, I think, you know, labor has been in the news. In 2011, labor was in the news a lot, with good reason, with what was going on with Wisconsin. There was a strike at Verizon. There was this possible strike here in New York by New York City building cleaners. There have been a fair number of labor battles, but one thing that people should remember is that in every case, the unions weren't really asking for anything more. They were sort of defending a status quo. They were sort of defending against something large being taken from them. In the case of Wisconsin, it was collective bargaining rights. In the case of Verizon, they wanted, you know, pension rights revoked they wanted health care givebacks. The union wasn't asking for anything more, even though Verizon was a highly profitable company. And I think the sort of ideological difference is, you know, Occupy Wall Street's message is the 1% has all the wealth. We want something more. We want something different. It's not a defensive. Occupy Wall Street isn't necessarily on the defensive. It's demanding a drastic change. And I think that if the union movement is going to change tactics, it's instead of, you know, gathering people at, you know, the Wisconsin State House to defend against Scott Walker's draconian plan, while that was a great action, the question, you know, the demand shouldn't be we should have collective bargaining rights. We should have collective bargaining rights and 20% raises over the course of our next contract. And if you don't have enough money for it, you should raise taxes on the wealthiest. I think. And there's a reluctance by...
Is there a history there? I mean, I think it's one of those things we sort of know. Have American unions been political before?
Well, I mean, the history of the unions is that a lot of them were always very close to the Democratic Party, because I think there was a point at which, there were a lot of people in the Democratic Party that, you know, labor and economic justice was, you know, central to their politics. But with, unions took a real beating under Reagan, and then the Democrats found their power with Clinton, which was to, and there was actually tangentially a similar thing that happened in Britain with the move of the British Labour Party, is that both the Labour Party and the Democrats decided to move away from unions and move away from working class issues, and not only move to the political center, but to find their power in corporate interests, people in the corporate world who might not be socially conservative. You might have be socially liberal, but wanted to, you know, align with business interests. Mm-hmm. So, I think that destroyed a lot of unions' political interests or political power, I should say. So, when you ask, have unions been political? I mean, you know, if you look at New York, I mean, mm-hmm. Unions have always been active in trying to pass the legislation that they wanted that would benefit their members, but. I think there could definitely be more. I mean, Cuomo, you know, reversed a little bit in terms of when he said he wasn't going to pass the millionaire's tax or extend the millionaire's tax, and I guess there was some tax plan that would keep some taxes on the wealthiest, but a lot of people say it's still not progressive enough. I mean, that could be a point, a political point that I think, you know, unions would take very seriously, because I think there are very few union members who would be adversely affected by a raise on the upper class. So.
So there is space for them to become political. You know, though it's funny because I'm more of a nerd, of history than and sort of just a newer activist in some ways. You know, I've been an activist for like 10 years, but I love the history. And you look at like the Flint strike, you know, the sit down strike. You know, you look at the Mother Jones rallies, 30,000 strong down Fifth Avenue. And that's kind of like when you're a teenage activist, the thing you picture in your head. Wow, could the union still do this? And you know. I guess sort of maybe that era is gone, but you're saying maybe there's stuff that it can pick up from ours. So, you know, if unions are to have a life, not just in New York City, but maybe throughout the United States, you know, off the top of your head, you know, let me not, what's the salvation of the unions? How do they, you know, they're like 9% of the private industry now, you know, they're terrible, terribly low, they're anemic. So what would, you know, what can unions do in the United States to not just be fighting a defensive battle, but to sort of be getting new ground and gaining membership and sort of taking over the labor market as well?
Yeah, I mean, it's very idealistic to say this, but I mean, I think it really does have to return to the type of action that you were talking about, the Flint sit-down strikes, things like that that actually forced employers to make major concessions because, right now, I mean, there was a strike at Verizon. Verizon, very profitable company. The union was on strike for about a week or two, and then left without a deal on the table. And you know, I've never really heard that what kind of details the employer has given. But you know, at the end of the day, the union comes off in a very weak spot, ending a strike without a deal, but also with no without even the idea of trying to organize people in the wireless, in the wireless section of Verizon. The dispute on background was that the dispute was between people who worked in wireline, people who worked with landline phones.
Mm-hmm.
People who work in the wireless network aren't union. But there was no... the union seemed... I'm not saying it wasn't interested, but it didn't seem to be a huge priority to... get those people into the union and to put the company in a situation where the only way that it would have the backbone of its union or the backbone of its operation back to work, the landline workers, would be some sort of concession to getting wireless workers into the union. I think the only way that you can pressure companies into doing that and rebuilding, you know, getting more people into unions is if members are willing to walk a line for a long time, but that's a lot to ask of working people, because their bills start to pile up. They've got mortgage payments. I think as far as successful strikes in the modern in the last maybe decade or so, people should look to the UPS strike of the mid 1990s, and what that means is that you have to organize workers years in advance, or about a year or two in advance, get people to have a strike fund going, you know, prepare for what it's going to mean, and have real demands on the table and be into it, you know, for the long haul. In the case of Verizon, I don't think there was that much preparation, or at least not the level of preparation there was with the Teamsters strike. So I think if there are a number of unions who are willing to really decide to take that step, they've got to look at some employers who are going to not only ask for some givebacks, but they can say, we're going to go on strike if we don't get major improvements in our pay, you know, 20-30% raises over the course of the life of the next contract, and I think this is essential, bringing more people into the union ranks. I don't think unions are going to survive just off getting benefits of their existing members. It has to grow its base in the new sector of workers.
I walked away from our conversation with a few distinct impressions. For one, the police, despite their unionization, had established an almost syndicate-type control over the labor market instead of a union-type control. And in my impression, that was more like a guild. That might just be me, speaking in my opinion here, than a union, where it didn't work towards general improvement for the workers, but sort of for immediate gains, and also worked on protecting the workers themselves from any dangers from the outside world. I also got the impression that labor had almost been surprised by the amount of energy that's potentially out there and the amount of skills that are potentially out there from an activist base that's pretty riled up and in their own way pretty experienced. So the two things that I really drew away were that maybe cops really aren't part of the 99% as much as I thought, and maybe the inroads we need to make there are much longer, much more difficult than I had originally thought. And the second impression was, as much logistical help as organized labor gave Occupied Wall Street, there was actually a lot that organized labor itself could get from Occupy Wall Street. And not just in terms of numbers, but numbers were there. But also this kind of energy and creativity and approach towards general political issues from a working class perspective. And that was something a little bit different than I guess my own experience as an activist would have even been 6 months ago or even 6 years ago, where organized labor was sort of seen by more general activists as a group that focused on particular lifestyle gains and specific wins for just their workers. And I'm really glad Ari broke down the difference between an industrial union and a craft union, one that sort of covers the whole industry and one that covers just the craft. And I think that distinction maybe helps bring up some of the history or helps enlighten some of the history as to why those two types of unions have acted differently. Another untold side of the Occupy Wall Street story, or perhaps one that is told but not focused on enough, is something that I too had probably focused on too little, and my concern for direct actions or arrests or goals or victories or losses. One of the things that happened in the interaction with the police is sort of the post-interaction. What happens to Occupy Wall Street protesters after they're arrested? Do they become a glut in the courts? Or do they come in as a pile and get huge fines? Are they slowed down from being activists? So I wanted to ask somebody who was involved with solidarity work around people who had been arrested. So I had a chance to speak with Kimberly Warner Cohen, who has been involved with Occupy Wall Street solidarity work for a few months now. We actually got to speak together on a panel at the Immodest Proposals 13, I believe it was. And recently, in fact Monday, she was down at court in solidarity with a lot of the Occupy Wall Street folks who had been arrested in the first mass action. I wanted to get her impression of that court appearance. I wanted to get some of the details of what happened. Then I wanted to get her impression as someone who's been involved from early on as to how the energy between activists and the police around Occupy Wall Street has changed. One small thing I'm going to ask you to keep in mind is that Kimberly, like a lot of the Occupy Wall Street activists, also has a job, and it's one of those misimpressions from the mainstream media that Occupy Wall Street kids or, you know, and that's sort of one of the misimpressions that these are just kids who don't have anything better to do. A lot of people involved with this movement have jobs or have kids or have responsibilities in the community we wouldn't at first imagine from the images being shown to us. So Kimberly is actually coming to us by phone. I hope you'll bear with us if the sound quality is a little choppy, so turn up your laptop a little extra loud and bear with us. Kimberly Warner Cohen now will be speaking to us about Occupy Wall Street solidarity in the courts and their future actions around a different sort of Occupy the Courts, this one having to do with Citizens United. So again, it's Kimberly talking to us about A, how the courts are sort of occupying us by taking the activist free time and sort of criminalizing them, putting them through the justice system, and what effect is that having on activists, how are they dealing with it, what's future action going to be, and then a sort of different Occupy the Courts, which is namely, how are we going to occupy the courts and undo the damage that's been done by Citizens United and the corporate control of politics? So I'm here today with Kimberly Warner Cohen. Am I saying that right?
Yep.
Who's been involved with Occupy from pretty early on. And we were speaking earlier about police involvement, what the relationship with us has been. And I have somebody here with me today who's sort of involved with two different sides of Occupy the Courts. One, which we'll talk about later, sort of involved in some future actions. And today, you are actually down to Occupy the Courts in a different way. There was sort of a court solidarity kind of mission. A lot of people went to court today relating to the first mass arrest from Occupy Wall Street. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Sure. All the arrests stemming from the 24th protest are disorderly conduct charges. So at our arraignment last month, a chunk of people took ACDs, which is a German concept of living dismissal, and the rest of us decided to go to trial. Today, as far as I know, the numbers may have changed, but out of the 84 of those 10 cases were immediately dismissed, I believe including the young women who got pepper sprayed, and the rest of us are taking it further.
Wow. Okay, so some folks are considering taking it forward, but some of the cases did get dismissed because a lot of the Twitter buzz today, there was a little bit of confusion. So about 10 cases, you would say, got dismissed?
I left by noon, and at that point, that had looked like the number, but, you know, I haven't checked Twitter today. I don't really know what the final numbers were, but that was the numbers I kept hearing.
Okay. What's your feeling? Are people just sort of saying, okay, thanks for this dismissal? Are some people openly challenging it, trying to drag their feet, trying to make an issue about this? Like, look, we were just in public space. Why did we even get arrested? How would the crowd split up, would you say? You know, in your estimate, are folks just happy to be getting off? Or, you know, are folks willing to drag it out in the system?
And that's sort of the standard first practice that one does.
What was that called again?
Everyone files a motion to dismiss. You know, it's just one of those, apparently, the first step that you just to try to throw it out on lack of evidence. And I know that the young women, there's plenty of YouTube of them just standing there. So that got thrown out. I don't know the details of the other people. But the rest of us and the people that I spoke to, we're all committed to going to trial.
Wow. That's pretty impressive. I think that's one of the things that's sort of different about this protest, at least in my observation, that folks are sort of even standing up against getting arrested for protesting. You know, like there's something wrong with that. I should have a certain freedom of speech. Did you get any of that feeling there?
Yes, like you said, there's something fundamentally not right about not being able to protest and speaking your mind for whatever reason. You know, I hate the Westboro Baptist, but more or less, I feel like they have the right to speak up the same way I have the right to speak up. And the fact that that's being quashed, especially with us, and mm-hmm. the police have come back so heavily. I've been protesting for 2 years now, and I've never seen so heavy-handed as what's going on now. During the court, not only did we have the regular bag checks and metal detectors, but we went up to our floor.
Mm.
We had a whole separate checkpoint, and I was joking that that's one more than from either like gone on to an international flight.
Wow.
I've never gone through two metal detectors before. All of us are standing up and saying, we did nothing wrong.
Yeah.
We have the right to protest. We have the right to disagree with what our government is doing. And, you know, it was funny, right after that arrest, nobody backed down. I'm sure there were a few, but by and large, nobody was intimidated. And everyone that I've spoke to, that core group of people, are not going to be deterred by the protesting around. And unfortunately, one of the things with the protests and with it's all very intimidating. And
mm-hmm.
I think we've all learned how to ignore that and be able to concentrate on our goals.
No, it seems definitely like there's almost like a militarization to the response, almost like criminalizing, free speech, basically free speech in public, you know?
It absolutely is. Not only the things are reaching, like Obama's you know, the National Defense Authorization Act, but just on a day-to-day, you know, street. There was one last month, and everyone was on the sidewalk, and it was the police who shut down Broadway. It was, we were on either side of Broadway on the sidewalk, and it was two rows of police on foot on Broadway and a whole lot of motorcycles. And every 10 feet, the police are videotaping. And, you know, it's oftentimes at the park, they use riot cops. And it's, you know, electronic panic, I can't think of the word again that they use on the eviction, like, these are all army techniques that a civilian police force is using. And that, you know, and that's nationwide, it's not only in New York. But the mindset has certainly changed. Any dissent is considered something to, as far as I'm concerned,
for abortion. One of the things I think as a journalist that's been sort of really alarming to see is the cops walking around with cameras and, you know, specifically pointing them at other people with cameras, like journalists, you know, and, you know, it's just a very odd response to have to free speech, where it's constantly not just repressing the free speech, but the people who could get out the message first, you know?
It's often this is, you know, historically in protests or in sort of action, it's usually the women, the medics, and the journalists that kind of left alone, and that hasn't been the case here at all. And, you know, the journalists being videotaped and the frozen zones and, you know, during the eviction, the video cameras were allowed in so no one could see what was going on. They don't want it to hit the news. And it's just, it's going on to things like YouTube, which is wonderful so it can get out and about. But YouTube is also taking those videos down. So they have this very effective media blackout going on. And it's just, it's difficult. It's more difficult now than it was.
That's very interesting. Would it be okay if we sort of went back a little bit? How, you know, let's talk a little bit about sort of those early days and how it was a little bit different from now. Could you talk a little bit about how you got involved in OWS and maybe some of the first things that attracted you to it and maybe a couple of the first major memories you've had with it? Because it's almost coming up on 4 months now on the 17th. So, you know, if you could talk to us a little bit about sort of what your experience was there, pretty early on, and sort of how it grew from there to now, where you're sort of planning for this action we're going to be talking about later.
Sure. I actually my friend stood me up to go to a concert, and I was feeling very sorry for myself. It was Saturday night. It was September 17th.
Mm-hmm.
I went on to Facebook and saw that there had been a protest against financial inequality around the world. And I, you know, got very excited and to make myself feel better and cheer up, I went down to Scotty. And I got there in time for the first TA and stuck around. And, you know, I'm in my mid-30s, so I'm a little bit older than the average age. But I was really, you know, I didn't think it was ever going to, no one thought that it was ever going to turn into this. But, you know, they were very earnest in what they had to say, and that really attracted me. And the issues that Occupy brought up and brought to the forefront are things that I've been very unhappy about for many years and thought there was just nothing I could do about it. And being around like-minded people and seeing that there's a bunch of us who are angry who aren't Tea Partiers was sort of a sense of relief. And, you know, especially in the early days before the cops started taking the low-level criminals hard and really trying to break things up all the time, there was this sense of community. And I'm usually pretty cynical about these things, but, you know, everyone was coming together. Everybody was helping out each other in some way. You know, at the time, early on, you could move your stuff around. I could drop my purse, and I'd come back 10 minutes later, and I'd grocery store with it. There was no animosity. That stuff only came later when the police, like I said, were directing the vagrants and the criminal things to the park. But you know, the next step now, the eviction, I'm not going to, you know, lie, the eviction was a blow to us in terms of central communication. We're sort of, you know, we have our hands in other things at the moment. Across the country, there's been a lot of movements to stop the Occupy foreclosed homes. We're still marching. January 20th, I'm involved in a, on January 20th, there's going to be a celebration, the city council last week voted against corporate personhood, and that was one of the decisions that was made by Citizens United 2 years ago. Corporations, in terms of campaign donations, are people because money equals speech, which is one of the basic tenets of Occupy Wall Street that we have a problem with. We're going to have sort of a celebration. We're going to march for a block and just be happy that we're in a city that recognizes that you can't buy your way. I think it's a basic, logical issue for anyone in America who stops and thinks about it. You know, the very idea that a corporation could theoretically run for office. A corporation, through their lobbying power and their massive amounts of money, have more say in what my politicians do than I do. And if that's the case, then why does our vote even matter?
It's an interesting question. If a corporation can have far, far more, exponentially more of a say with our politicians or in our politics than we the individuals can, or we as a populace can, then what does our vote really add up to? So, and that action that Kimberly is talking about is an Occupy the Courts action on January the 20th. If you're looking for a website to contact or to organize with, check out ows.reconfigure.com. That's ows.reconfigure.com. ows.reconfigure.com. Of course, besides Occupy the Courts, Occupy Wall Street will be involved in two other very big actions in the next 2 weeks. Occupy the Dream, which harkens back to MLK's original call for a fair economic system in America, and of course Occupy Congress, which if I'm correct here, I believe all the tickets from New York are already sold out, but I'm sure you can still find one of those cheap low budget buses out there. Now I see that I'm coming to the end of my time. Unfortunately, I lack the wherewithal to really have a Jerry Springer last thought type epilogue to this show, but I do have one sort of overarching kind of theme that I hope you'll keep in mind. Most of the best democratic things that have happened over the last 4 months have happened because people have gone out there and done it themselves, have gone out there and organized themselves, have gone out there and publicized their movements themselves. It is not for them to wait around for a pro-corporate, corporate-based, corporate lifeline media to come around and save them and highlight their movement and show them what to do. That simply doesn't make sense to expect that a corporate media and a corporate system is going to go out of its way to show you an anti-corporate alternative. So with that in mind, I definitely want to give a special thank you to the good folks at Here Be Monsters. I know they've been doing this for years, and it's wonderful to see grassroots media succeeding so well. I also want to thank Gwen. Gwen, you're freaking awesome. You put in a lot of work that a lot of folks don't see. I also wanted to thank my guest, Ari Paul. It was absolutely wonderful to speak to him in such an informal setting. Ari, thanks for having me over to your house on such a busy day for you. I really, really appreciated it. And I definitely want to thank Kimberly. I know she's been very busy preparing for this big action celebration on Friday, January the 20th, involving Occupy the Courts. If you're looking to get involved with that, of course, the website is ows.reconfigure.com. That's ows.re-configure.com. Thank you so much for your time, Kimberly. Good luck with all your work, Fighting Citizens United. And finally, thank you to all of our listeners here who spent nearly an hour with me. Thank you for your patience. And this is my first podcast, so please, please forgive me for the extra choppy sound here and there. Thank you very much for sharing in this crazy experiment called Democracy with me, and I hope to see you out there. Thank you so much, and I'm leaving you now with a track from one of my favorite underground artists who I hope you'll check out, IMIC. He's the gentleman with the Hello song at the beginning. The following song is called Change. It's been a long time coming, like a Sam Cooke song. I'll see you out there, folks. One love, one struggle.
Coming like a Sam Cooke song. Recite my lyrics like a holy book song. True Muslims that follow the Quran would never commit suicide, strapped to a bomb. Real priests that practice their religion will get sent to prison for molesting little children. Now I'm a sinner, I have my vices, but also realize the soul is priceless. In this day and age, it don't pay to spit the truth, but what I convey on a page displays the proof that real MCs still exist and flip like bipolar. I'm a soul of eclipse. I'm like Rakim getting stronger the older I get, but have my doubts more often than I care to admit. But I'm an heir to the throne of the microphone king that still believes it ain't too late to change things. So
fly with me, don't you hear me? Fly with me, don't you hear me? Fly with me, don't you hear me?
When the evil wants in, I create a way to barricade it. Use a phrase to narrate it, meditate in Aramaic. When I look at the Middle East, I see Isaac and Ishmael. And violence is a reoccurring pattern like fish scales. And the actions of those in uniforms of brutality, exempt from punishment due to minor technicalities. While the fatalities in the street increases, when I seek peace, I speak to Jesus. The Most High's third eye's been filming us forever. Watch my life change like Malcolm X on a pilgrimage to Mecca. See past the lies buried in a bibliotheca, or the images of idolatry betrayed by video directors. Even the slang whack, I hang back in the shadows. Computer rappers on Hewlett Packard's wanna battle. But I'm an heir to the throne of the microphone kings that still believes it ain't too late to change things. So come on, come on. Ain't got time to chill, no. Because the sun don't freeze, no. Ain't got time to chill, no. Because the sun don't freeze. Ain't got time to chill, no. Because the sun don't freeze. Well, as I make my way through this physical dimension on a spiritual mission, using lyrical ammunition to leave demons hardly breathing in a critical condition. My soul power is energy efficient. No man knows the hour, but I saw the Twin Towers in Revelation. The day that Babylon stopped trading for gas stations to patients that can't pay the medication fee. I hate waiting, so I'm just pacing impatiently. So question my creation of soul from ancient seed. The nation destined for devastation. The soul of Satan seed. They want control like the Federal Emergency Management Agency and spread misinformation like a highly contagious disease. But I'm immune to that bullshit. If knowledge is a bullet, I got a full clip. And the trigger I pull quick, cause I'm an heir to the throne of the microphone king that still believes it ain't too late to change things. So
this has been Practice Democracy, a part of Here Be Monsters. Please look for a listing for the next episode on Wednesday at 5 p.m. Thank you for listening. As I said, this has been Practicing Tomorrow, and this is Here Be Monsters. Good night.